Hi, I'm Doug Gordon. Welcome back to Beta from Wisconsin Public Radio. The British band Tok Tok formed in 1981. They started out as a synth-pop band, but evolved into an organic experimental group that blended elements of jazz, classical, and ambient music to create their own unique sound. The band's mysterious mastermind, Mark Hollis, was constantly striving to take creative risks with Tok Tok sound. Their hits included It's My Life and Life's What You Make It. Mark Hollis died in February 2019 from cancer. He was 64. Ben Wardle has written the first finished biography about Mark. It's called Mark Hollis, A Perfect Silence. As one critic has said, Ben's book will make you listen. Beta's resident musicologist, Steve Gotcher, sat down to talk with Ben.
Ben, one of the most intriguing things I read about Mark Hollis came from a quote by him in your book, A Perfect Silence. He said, "The most important thing for me about any record is the silence above everything. I would rather hear one note than I would two, and I would rather hear nothing rather than I would one note." Can you expand on that idea, and how did it affect Mark's approach to music?
It was important because I think he recognized the importance of space on a record, and that was, I think, informed by his wide-ranging listening that he was doing. You know, he wasn't just obviously into one genre, certainly wasn't into just rock and pop. That was something that he kind of got out of his system before he was 25, almost. So, yeah, his love of jazz and atonal classical music was informing a lot of the latter period of Tok Tok, and certainly his solo album.
Right, and yet early Tok Tok is not really very spacious, but as the career of the band and then Mark's solo album comes along, you can hear less as time goes by.
Yeah.
Would you say that's a fair assessment?
Yeah. I mean, I suppose, you know, you can compare him to a lot of... This is so easy to do, isn't it, to sort of make broad, sweeping comparisons, but you can compare him to a lot of artists, you know. Is it, he kind of got, as he got better at his art, as he kind of knew more and more about what he wanted to achieve, he simplified and edited and honed in the same way that, you know, you look at some of the great sort of pictorial artists, the way their early work is detailed and sometimes a little bit muddy and kind of clears towards the as they get older and more mature. But I mean, he took the silence and love of it to real logical conclusion, really, in the sense that he ultimately did end up going silent and never produced another bit of commercial music until he died, really.
Now, Mark's older brother, Ed, who died in 1989, had a major influence on the develop of Mark's musical knowledge. How did he do that?
Well, he was a man of mystery in the sense that no one seemed to be able to tell me where he got his money from, but he certainly managed to get enough money to have a record collection that had him locally known as 1000 Eddie. This was in the early 1970s in Southend, you know, so they lived in a satellite town outside London in Essex, and yet he was the most switched on and connected person in terms of all the new music that was coming out. He seemed to, you know, any money he had, he would spend on records. And buying the stuff wasn't very easy because a lot of it wasn't available. You had to order it on import. You know, so a lot of the American records that he played, people like the Stooges and the MC5, you know, no one in his peer group had heard because they didn't know it was accessible because it wasn't really being written about. And two, he was the only one who'd had the foresight to order it from a shop in the centre of London. So, you know, imagine what it was like for Mark, who at that point was not yet 16 and hearing all this stuff, being exposed to that stuff at an early age. It was almost like having a personal kind of Spotify in the early 1970s. And that, as one of my interviewees said, you know, if he was a reasonable songwriter to begin with, the fact that he had all that influence at such an early stage really would have helped him along.
Mark wanted Tok Tok to be a guitarless band and the lineup to be closer to a jazz quartet. Why was that?
Yeah, he said that a lot. I don't think that was a lie. I don't think that he was just sort of saying that. I think that's really genuinely what he would have liked. And I suspect that's based around the fact that he saw his voice as another instrument. So in his head, it was like the John Coltrane Love Supreme lineup with a keyboard, a bass, drums, and a lead instrumentalist, i.e. him, his voice. You know, basically he wanted to be successful, like everyone who forms a band and writes songs and, you know, plays live. He wanted fans. And if you look around, you know, the landscape at that time, there were a lot of bands without guitars. Or a lot of bands that had a synth-led sound. And that's exactly what Talk Talk had. And I don't think it's just a coincidence. You know, I think the story that Mark told and played out in interviews was that it was a coincidence that they had a synth. He didn't like synths, but it was the cheapest way of getting a kind of the sound that he wanted to get without hiring in lots of other musicians. You listen to that first album and even the second album, the vastly superior second album, It's My Life. You know, they're synth records, really. I think Mark possibly wound people up, which he enjoyed doing, must be said, winding journalists up, by kind of constantly going on about his, you know, the jazz influences, because no one could hear them. You can definitely hear them as time goes on, and they have a little bit more money, and that's the story, again, that Mark told him. The more money they had, the more real instruments they could get in.
Now, from 1981 to 1991, Talk Talk produced 5 studio albums. But with their third album, The Color of Spring, from 1986, the music changed from a more pure pop sound to a more art pop sound. What caused that change?
Well, the change was caused by the fact that they had a little bit more money, so they could hire in more session musicians, some of whom had already played on It's My Life, but they'd had a huge success with It's My Life in Europe. So that's fundamentally, there's some money, they've recouped to EMI, and there's a confidence there with Mark and Tim Freese-Green, the co-writer and producer of Talk Talk. So they feel like they've got it, you know, they've got something that's going to work. Ironically, Dave Ambrose didn't think there was a hit on the record, and they went away and consciously wrote something to be a hit, which is, I love the fact that they went away, you know, confidently and did that and wrote Life's What You Make It, which various people who I interviewed told me that they had consciously said, right, well, Kate Bush has just had a big hit with a song that is just like a looped drum riff and one chord. We could do that. And then other people have said that it was just inspired by Can. But nonetheless, they produced that, which is probably, arguably in Britain anyway, their most well-known track. They were still producing pop, but it was much less synth-led and much more three-dimensional. Lots of beautiful kind of vistas of sound opening up. And certainly the B-side, It's Getting Late in the Evening, of the first single of the album, it's kind of points the way where Hollis would go after that album.
So in 1988, the band sound was reinvented again with the album Spirit of Eden. Why was there such a change, and how was it received?
Well, they're finally successful in their home country as well as Europe, and that confidence played out in making Spirit of Eden. The difference really was that, you know, Mark became a father, the band were maturing, and also, crucially, they'd finished a long tour promoting Colour of Spring, and he said, that's it, I'm no longer touring. No, it's kind of, you know, that line in the sand. So I think he was a happier person knowing that he didn't have to go out and promote this thing. Of course, when they did deliver it, everyone, aside from he and Tim Freese-Green, were slightly concerned about how to market it. The industry at large were quite anticipating another colour of spring, and including EMI. And so there was a quite complex and fractious relationship that started developing between EMI and the band. And they, for many months, sat on the record not really knowing what to do with it, which resulted in there being a court case. So they managed to get out of EMI whilst simultaneously releasing that record. Ironically, it got the best reviews of any of the records they'd ever released and the poorest sales.
The band's final album, Laughingstock, came out in 1991 and continued to explore a more spacious sound. How was that accepted at the time when it came out?
Well, I mean, I speak for myself. When I was a big fan at the time, because I got into them around the time of Spirit of Eden, and I was really looking forward to Laughingstock, and I just didn't get it. I wasn't musically sophisticated enough, I think, to understand it. That's the way I look back on it now, because I really, really like it now. Still don't like it as much as A Spirit of Eden, but it's an undeniably great record. But at the time, many people thought they were taking the piss, you know, and largely that was, you know, based on the fact that it was noisy, much noisier than Spirit of Eden, loads more guitars, which Tim Freeze Green was behind. He was always kind of like the more rockier of the two, you know. In the meantime, he'd been producing bands like the Catherine Wheel and Lush, and getting into the sort of so-called shoegazing scene that was going on in the UK at that time. And there was way more kind of out there kind of sonics going on. And it was just not well accepted. A lot of people in the industry thought that the name of the album was a direct reference to Polydor, who'd just signed them for £2 million. And they didn't know what to do with it. They tried, you know, again, you know, we think, oh, rubbish record label, they didn't do anything. But, you know, they made a real effort at releasing three singles, none of which were ever going to get any airplay, and they knew that at the time, but they released them in a kind of creative sort of collect the set type artwork covered box. Interestingly enough, that same week that the record came out, I think the week afterwards, Nevermind came out. So that puts it in perspective as to what was kind of, you know, the context in which Laughingstock was emerging.
Right, now Mark's solo record explores an even more spacious and minimal sound. Do you think he finally found the sound that he was looking for?
I don't think there was ever a definitive sound he was looking for throughout his career. You know, he found the sound he was looking for was there on each of the, certainly on each of the last two Talk Talk records, if not also The Colour of Spring. I think it's a lot more minimal. There's no drums, it's all acoustic, it was recorded all analogue. So there's a journey there with his pursuit of getting away from anything that could possibly date a record or enable people to pinpoint exactly when it was made. There's a quotation he says that, you know, the best thing that to go for in any record is to make a record that doesn't sound like it was made in the time in which it was made. And that's certainly, you know, he certainly did that with his final solo album. Come on.
So how do you think Mark Hollis is going to be remembered in music history?
Well, I'd like to think he's going to be remembered more for his music, more than for the all of the kind of stories that go along with him being this person who was battling against the record industry. That was the main, I think, in some respects, the main thing I wanted to dispel was this man who was just, you know, he represented everything that mythologizing journalists like to believe that artists can be, you know, battling against the horrible forces of commerce. He was just making some great music, and he wanted as many people as possible to like it, and he was obviously wanting to make a living, but he wanted to do it on his own terms. And he did, you know, and I think anyone who can constantly fly in the face of public opinion and do the thing that he's constantly being advised against doing, and then end up still being listened to 30 years later, is a genius.
Ben Wardle, thank you so much for talking with us today about your book, Mark Hollis, A Perfect Silence. It's a great book.
A pleasure. Thank you. Thanks, Steve.
Ben Wardle is the author of Mark Hollis, A Perfect Silence. He talked with Steve Gotcher. Find out more at wpr.org/beta. Well, that does it for this edition of Beta. Thanks to our guests, Julie Nolke, Van Lathan, and Ben Wardle. Beta is available to follow on Spotify or wherever you catch your favorite pods. And you can keep up with us during the week online at wpr.org/beta or on Twitter at @WPRBeta.
Even for the internet, it's pretty shocking.
Beta is a production of Wisconsin Public Radio and Red Meat Productions. Our technical director and producer is Steve Gotcher.
I don't judge a man by the length of his hair or the kind of music he listens to. Rock was never my bag.
Tyler Ditter is our engineer.
Well, that may not mean anything to you, but that means a lot to me.
Our executive producer is Adam Friedrich.
I've seen your type before. Flashy, making the scene.
And thanks to you, our alphas. More Beta comes your way next week. Until then, I'm Doug Gordon.
You think because you're a celebrity that somehow the law doesn't apply to you, that you're above the law?